Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Today, we got another rainy day in Boston. And for those of you who watched the Boston Marathon and saw the sideways rain coming down, you got an idea of what our spring has been like. But you know what? For folks that are raising crops or animals, slow and steady rain is really not a bad thing. So it's a good thing. It's to be welcome. We'll take that any day, I guess. Today, we're going to talk about some of those things within food and agriculture and the environment and connect it with things like finance. And we're going to put this into a single bucket of circular economies. I'm joined today by two very knowledgeable thought leaders in the space, and they're bookending the better food movement from the West Coast and the East Coast. Today, we have Wendy Millett, who's the director of Tom Kent Ranch and Research Center. Hey, Wendy, how you doing?
Howdy, howdy.
Thanks for joining. We appreciate it. And we also have the CEO of Stone Barn Center, Jill Eisenbarger. Jill, how you doing?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Jill, and you know, we look at this. You and I know you're in Tarrytown, New York, which is just north of the city. And Wendy is in, you know, just south of Half Moon Bay. So you're dealing with the same weather that I am here in Boston. And Wendy is in sunny California, just smiling the whole day. So she's got it right, I think. She's the smart one, kind of going from the east to the west and spending time out there.
Yeah, it's pretty glorious. Our spring is here, and the grass is green, and it's glorious. But you know what our browns will look like in the summertime.
That's so. Right. There we go. We'll take that. You know, I wanted to mention I was describing what Sourcing Matters was to a friend the other day. And I was trying to describe effectively what we've done about 17 of these episodes now. And I was trying to describe it. Basically, I come to the conclusion that we're a bit like a late night talk show. You know, I kind of open with a monologue and I'll ask questions. We have great guests. It's the guests that are really the draw. That's the key point. And, you know, I'm definitely define myself as a show host. I'm not a journalist, but I do work on educating and entertaining folks and about really important and pressing issues effectively. And to be, what was interesting is the day after I told my friend about this, thinking I came to this incredible conclusion of, wow, I'm onto something here. I got really refined thought of who I am, that I'm trying to democratize subject matters for a broader understanding. Literally the next day, Sean Hannity, who just got into hot water, comes out and basically almost verbatim said the same thing, that he's not a journalist. He's a late show host, a late night show host. He tries to educate and entertain Americans on pressing issues. So what great company I'm in, huh, guys? I mean, aren't you excited to be on the show? Now it's just like, you know, what's the equivalent of a Sean Hannity? But, you know, the other difference is I don't make $30 million a year like he does. So there's a big difference, I guess, in the underpinning of what we're trying to get across.
There's a lot of time for you to be discovered,
Aaron. Jill, that is very nice. Thank you very much. I like that. Hey, let's talk about this. Let's jump into food, agriculture, environment, finance. And you know, so we're dealing with a lot of craziness in this country, obviously. And even today, we got President Macron, who's become effectively the EU's Trump whisperer. He is presenting to Congress, explaining to our leadership that we do not have a planet B here. And that almost making a very pragmatic appeal to them, saying that if you want to protect all of your individual riches, you better wake up and start thinking differently about what's going on with our planet. And even on the financial side here, which gets a bit of a bad rap, there's been some interest in impact investing or green investing, but we're seeing a sea change, from my perspective at least, in the Financial Times has put out an interesting publication, a report. It's an article that was called Looking at Green Investing That Generates Returns and Not Just a Warm Glow. In the article, they describe Al Gore, who's teaming up with some past Goldman Sachs execs, to launch a new investment vehicle called Generation. And the focus of Generation is to look at conscious investment, But not focused on impact-based returns, which notoriously have been lower than traditional returns. And I thought this was a very unique way of looking at this differently. And you know, I wanted to start our conversation today with you, Wendy. So last fall, you hosted the first annual Circular Economies Idea Hack. It was a symposium that brought together multiple disciplines to determine where we all connect and what we can learn from one another to benefit a future circular economy. It seems to me, at least, again, that this is an opportunity to evaluate regenerative natural resource management as somewhat of a new cost basis for, I think your goals are set by 2050. So Wendy, could you tell us a little bit more about the concept and what you seek to bring forth in coming years with your symposium?
Yeah, sure. And giving credit where credit's due, we hosted that event last fall in partnership with a group out of Wyoming called Healthy Business, Healthy Planet. At the encouragement of the folks over there at that organization who are working with Yvonne Chouinard from Patagonia, who's also really interested in this topic. And so how we started thinking about the idea was from actually agriculture, because agriculture arguably is one of the businesses in the world where there are examples of truly regenerative work. And the kind of goal of the regenerative is something where you're using, you're replenishing the resources and not leaving the action in a worse place than it was. So from that place, agriculture and regenerative agriculture specifically, the kind that we're practicing here at the ranch, was the starting place for that. And then through the conversations, we said, well, what could we learn from agriculture and apply to other businesses that are looking to have, you said it in the conscious investment phase, like just changing the paradigm and treat entirely so that it's not about even just sustaining a business practice, which really kind of just slows down a rate of depletion, to building something that's regenerative, that can replenish the planet in the course of that action. So that's what we were just working on, and we broke into affinity groups, trying to hone in on business areas where people could move forward with a set of actions together that were in that spirit regenerative.
And you know, regenerative is a great terminology for it, right? And actually, one of Jill's advisors, Fred Kirschenman, concisely phrases it that everything is renewed in the process of using it. And I think that's kind of a nice, clean baseline for us to look at what regenerative can really represent. And what I found interesting from those affinity groups is, yeah, they were from all different disciplines across the board, but maybe half the folks there were within food systems. So do you see food, and specifically food animals, because that correlation to looking at animals, agriculture, environment, and finance as a potential anchor industry to help prove out this new fiduciary model?
Well, for sure we do, informed by our experience here at the ranch, where we've actually using the grazing herd of cattle to try to regenerate the soil. We had a ranch that when we first started here, the ranch was really, had been heavily used, heavily farmed. You could pay to throw your car in the creek. There was just a lot of misuses of this place. So where we came in thinking that we wanted to do sustainable agriculture, we didn't want to sustain that state. So looking around at how we could actually make it better led us to the impact that grazing animals can have on the planet and that source of compost that they are and the source of building healthy soil while increasing the carbon that can increase the carbon that's sequestered, increasing the biodiversity, raising a healthy food product that would then provide rural economies a source of income. That's the sort of circular logic that we feel like the animal agriculture in particular plays a role.
That's very interesting, right? You had a situation where man, had such depletive effects. I think I remember that they even were scraping the soil off to send it down the road, right, to Big Sur, to different locations.
Yep.
Yeah, and now you've got an opportunity to really test out what can happen by man having a different approach to actually looking at this as best practices, using animals as those translators to build that all essential soil health, that living sponge so essential for really making all of our systems work. And it was exciting to get a tour of what you're doing out there again, not just to enjoy that incredible weather out there and just to take a break for a few, but just to see what you guys have established. And to your credit, Wendy, it looks wonderful. And I'm excited to see what you continue to do with that in the conference as well as at the ranch. So Jill, let's jump in on from your side. So you, as we mentioned, you're the CEO of Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture. And prior to that appointment in 2009, you served as the chief of staff at the Nature Conservancy. That's the world leading conservation organization, 3,500 employees, 34 countries, $1 billion budget. Just that's big time. And I think very young to be in that role, really, really quite impressive, and young to be as the CEO of Stone Barns, and obviously deserving of these opportunities. And what I want to talk a bit about with you on this is to say, so you, in 2009, that's a bit early to recognize the potential of connecting food and agriculture to properly shepherding natural order. And that's effectively what I look at the Nature Conservancy doing, is looking at how we can be part of the system instead of trying to only control it. So you left that world-leading conservation organization, helped run Stone Barn Center. So what led to that decision to use agriculture as this incredible vehicle for conservation? And have you seen that landscape in production that connects the environmental change since you've come there in this near decade of being at Stone Barns?
Yeah. Great question, and thank you for calling me young. I got really excited through my work at the Nature Conservancy about food, kind of based on a couple of ideas. And the first was what I was seeing happen in the conservation movement, and in particular at the Nature Conservancy, the places where I thought the organization had the best chance at long-term success were places where we were working really closely with local communities that had some kind of economic and stewardship interest in the land. So people living in a place were really emotionally and economically tied to the land. So I'd see it with watermen we'd work with in the Chesapeake Bay, or foresters who I got to work with in Maine, or folks from our team in Indiana and Illinois working with farmers. And I really loved the knowledge that I was able to garner from getting to interact with those foresters and farmers and watermen and others. And got really excited about the idea of regionalization in conservation and food and working landscapes. And so had a dream of working in a deeper way in one of those industries that was so closely and obviously tied to the long-term stewardship and health of the land. And then the second thing was I spent a lot of time while working at the Nature Conservancy working in the marketing division, and got to work on beautiful creative projects that tried to get people to be more emotionally connected to the environment. And one of the things that I saw was so many of the ideas that we were trying to get people to care about and that we would talk about were abstract. So it was pollution that, you know, depending on where you lived, you might or you may or may not be able to see it, or it's the idea of climate change, which just seems so big. As an individual, people really were, you know, asking lots of questions about what they could do, or maybe interested intellectually in the science, but not forming that deep emotional connection that I think you need to get people to form to take lifelong action on behalf of a cause. And I was really curious about whether or not food could provide that more direct connection to get people to care about conservation and the environment. So I was excited to have the opportunity to come work with the team at Stone Barns, which is a very public-facing institution, to explore that idea. You know, is this an inroad to get more people to be interested in biodiversity is food and the personal connection we make to food, something that could help effectuate more action and more change in the conservation movement.
It's essential epicenters that you've now developed at Stone Barns, where you've got 100, 150,000 people. We joked with Jack Algier that you've got these free-range New Yorkers coming all over your farm. How do you deal with them all the time? And that can be a challenge. But, you know, looking at that, that's one of the goals that you're trying to get across, as with you, Andy, too, and looking at this is an educational realm. What you are getting across is teaching a next generation of consumers. You're trying to get across to the next generation of farmers and ranchers that this is the way. The only way for the future of agriculture is either sustainable, regenerative, resiliency built into this. And it's a new operating system. And if we don't have the best practices for using those operating systems, it's effectively doomed to fail. So I think both of you, and again, the bookending our food movement, regenerative food movement, it's exciting what you've even evolved in. Even less than a decade of proving that. So Wendy, let's talk more about Tomcat Ranch and the Educational Foundation. So for more than 20 years, you've helped bridge that the love of conservation and working landscapes with practical economic solutions and effective partnership. And so you have an innovative and really small, nimble team of conservation biologists and livestock managers to work together to implement conservation grazing, and document the benefits of that ranch's water, soil, climate, and biodiversity. So what I think we'd mentioned here, that you have a research center, you obviously host events, you bring a lot of thought leaders to your space. But one thing that I'd like to bring up for our audience, which you also do, and this is really getting to Jill's point, which is it's, you know, this is so big, so what can you do? So making it applicable around sustainable and successful businesses is an essential part here to get people to grasp on to this. And so aside from that on-field research center of land, animal, and human health, you also operate a grass-fed beef operation called Left Coast Grass-Fed out of the ranch in the region. According to the website, you state that you sell and raise on the coastal range of San Mateo County of California. And you're developing, again, a sustainable business model to prove out the values of differentiated food. Boy, that seems like an essential opportunity or potential way to scale and gain broader adoption for these elevated standards. So how has your approach at Left Coast, or your involvement, and I know there's a couple different teams working on this, but as a whole within Tomcat and Left Coast, how has it evolved since the brand launched, and what can we expect to see in the future with this?
Where to start? Maybe going back to the beginning. So Left Coast Grass-Fed by design was meant to be a way to gain insights into the challenges and opportunities that face grass-fed producers. So in the context of our learning lab, it's a pretty small business. It's not set up to support us economically, but it is support set up so that we can learn what people who are in the livelihood business, making a real living, doing grass-fed production, are confronting, so we can help on those sort of bigger levers. So from the beginning, we started selling at farmers markets. It gives us a chance to sit down at the table and hear what consumers are interested in. We sell at a variety of markets. Santa Cruz, if you know California very well, is a different kind of market than Palo Alto, which is very different than the San Francisco Mission Market. You know, at Mission Market, for example, we can do some food support systems for low-income urban dwellers. Santa Cruz, we tend to sell a lot of the odd cuts. Bone broth's really a popular. But anyway, and more recently we've started focusing or selling to more local restaurants who are interested in mission-aligned local food. But really the key thing about that beef business, as I said, is looking at those challenges and opportunities. We chose to follow a bunch of certifications so we could learn what the certifications mean for a producer, both on the good side and bad side. So we're American Grass-Fed certified, we're animal welfare certified. We believe the certifications will help consumers understand what we stand for But as you know, and as anybody who goes to the grocery store knows, the certifications are really confusing. Mm-hmm. So what do we do about that? How can we help in, you know, marketing, telling that story? That's an example of something that we are looking at. Some of the other things that are really challenging for small producers is, you know, how to tap consumer demand and get people to pay for things like high-value products. We've actually made a choice that every pound of our meat, we would intentionally design a sales channels where we could have maximum impact for our mission. So we would prefer, you know, if we have a choice to work with chefs who are advocacy chefs, we'll choose that kind of place, to those partners to work with, because those are people who are excited about educating consumers about a regenerative food movement. And so we have the luxury to push some of that, sometimes even partnering and donating some of that meat so that we can help get the message out. We do a school food program, and we donate a fair amount of meat to our local school food program as a way, and we send our sales team out, our farmers market team out, to talk to the kids in the school or talk to the food systems producers who produce the meals about how that food's grown and why it matters. So those are the kind of things that we're doing with that. I mean, where it goes in the future, we're in a bubble. Obviously, Silicon Valley is super high foodie culture, but I guess there's lots of bubbles around the country, because I know you guys have one in Boston and New York, and I'd say most of the big cities seem to have their food bubble. And so where, you know, there's a big, very inexpensive industrial food system out there, there seems to be increasingly high demand for this alternative, more regenerative food system. Grass-fed itself, some people are quoting that it's growing 90% a year, as people, especially health-driven consumers, are thinking about what they're eating, where is it coming from, what goes into raising an animal, transporting meat from one place to another, and even the quality of the soil that feeds the plants, that feeds us, that brings those nutrients to a nutrient-dense food product. So I could go on and on, but that's just a few things about what we do with our West Coast grass-fed beef business.
That's great. It's true systems thinking. It's looking at it from the ground up, and you being a bit of the tip of the spear allows you to look at those multi-dimensional returns, as you spoke of getting those impact chefs, the folks that will help proliferate these stories and really make that narrative. So yeah, we are in a bubble, but it does become, when are we crossing the chasm? When are we getting to that point when the consumer really is a driving force? And we have yet to see it as much in meat, obviously. And I think you're right that there's issues when we've got six standards for grass-fed, or the consumer's dealing, I think the report says 200 standards or certifications that they have to deal with when going buying food categories. But there are successful models being used in coffee, in beer, in wine, where the variables, the multi-dimensions that people are looking at aside from just price, they matter in the buy decision. And it could be terroir or roasting practice or fair wage. And what we have an opportunity, it seems, and again, you are tip of the spear moving this in the right direction. It's exciting what's happened out in California is that type of awareness seems to be percolating to more. And speaking of awareness, Jill, let's talk a little bit about what you guys do with your educational programs at Stone Barns. And what I just saw, actually just came out, I think, yesterday, is you announced the Stone Barns Exchange Fellowship programs for 2018. This year, which is focused on the intersection of climate, food, and agriculture. How apropos for our conversation today. You really didn't have to build a whole fellowship program just for our conversation today, Jill, but I appreciate it. Can you tell us a bit more about the 9 women who were selected for the 2018 program?
Sure. So one of the hallmarks of the work we do at Stone Barns is we try to bring together people from different disciplines. So one of the ideas that we're experimenting with here is trying to facilitate conversation between all kinds of different people who can influence the food system. So we have a program here called Slow Tools, and that's a conversation between engineers and farmers, and we have ongoing conversation between the farmers and chefs who work on our campus, and many others who visit, who represent different academic disciplines or professional disciplines. And so this program is really a very deliberate way to try to bring together a diverse set of thinkers. And this year's class has food entrepreneurs, so people who are relatively early in their career, maybe the first 10 years, a restaurateur, a couple writers and journalists, a policy advocate who's really interested in building soil health programs into agricultural policy in this country, a commercial fisherwoman. And, you know, our hope is that by having this cohort come together, we can facilitate some really creative conversations about solutions to challenges that they are having in their work and in their communities. And I think it will be a really, really exciting summer. And just as I've read and learned more about cross-disciplinary work, there's some really beautiful stories out there. One story I read was about a mechanical and aerospace engineering professor at Princeton who studies the collective motion of schools of fish and flocks of birds. And she was giving a talk at Princeton, and a woman who is a choreographer, so a dancer and choreographer, was there and asked her if they could do some scientific experimentation using her dance class that reflected the work she was seeing when she was tracking fish and bird flocks. And so they would design choreographic ideas where dancers would be asked to stay an arm's length away and they'd observe what happened. And leaders would emerge as a result of this, and they were able to make all kinds of observations that kind of married the social sciences and the hard sciences. And so it's that kind of creative exchange and serendipity that we don't all get to experience in our everyday professional lives that we're hoping this fellowship will facilitate, and that it'll lead to some creative ideas that help us make change in the food system.
Isn't it so cool to veg out on Nat Geo and watch those shows where you watch the bird flocks and like you said,
so
how
cool
does that happen? How do you have 100,000 fish in a school that all know,
right,
each other? Go, it's just, it is incredible. And you know, I think some of the times we take it for granted. We forget, you know, it's like taking soil for granted. You plant a seed in the ground and it grows. Well, there's 7 billion microbes in every tablespoon of soil that are all doing their work to get us there. How does that operate? Mm-hmm. How does it set up? And that type of approach of becoming more aware as consumers, or really identifying, Jill, in that case, you know, these nine incredible fellows that you guys have earmarked to help get the story out, to put this in context with that may not, mm-hmm, just be only around food and ag, but has, mm-hmm, a connection point, is seems essential as we are now tackling, it seems, some of the biggest problems facing humanity. And I think that storyline is lost on many of what's actually happening at a mass scale across the world to these regenerative natural resources. So I'm excited to see the results of that fellowship program. So, Wendy, let's talk a bit. You mentioned you're close to Silicon Valley, stone's throw, in fact. So you obviously are pushing the envelope here with herd management and how that connects to environmental practice. But what I've seen, or talked to some early stage companies within this innovation economy, is you also test out. You become a little bit of ground zero, especially in food animal management and ruminant and bovine management. Some of those innovations that are amassing in food and ag tech. So could you share with our audience, speaking of a little bit of a transition of things that people have more awareness of, and that's innovation and technology, but we're seeing this in even the last year, 18 months, coming on at mass scale. Could you share with our audience some of the interesting technologies that you're utilizing on the ranch?
And a shout out, because one of the reasons we've been able to do that is because my husband is an ag tech guy, so he's introduced us to a variety of people. I spend most of my day on the ranch, and fortunately he spends a bunch of time in Silicon Valley itself, so shout out to him for getting us connected with some really interesting technologies, and it's kind of fun to bring them out, because somebody in Silicon Valley who's trying to figure out a GPS-enabled collar for livestock doesn't really often know exactly how the livestock are going to react to this kind of thing, and that's where we've been able to offer that we would be a demo for certain technologies that would help us in our mission. And really, you know, the focus in that is what are the technologies and tools that can help scale regenerative ranching, that can give ranchers cost-effective, reliable, actionable feedback from their land, and that can help the ranchers see both the short and long-term effects of their management. Ideally, open source data, you know, sharing with other ranchers. You mentioned our science work, and that science work is being done by Point Blue Conservation Science. They've actually developed something called the Rangeland Monitoring Network, and it's a statewide monitoring network here in California that Point Blue leads the way on. It uses a standardized method and metrics for measuring the rangeland health. They measure vegetation, birds, soil, and once they figured it out to do it here, we worked with them to get those same metrics and monitoring done at 80 ranches across California, because one of the things in agriculture, it's pretty cool, right? And it's really taken off. And it's so important because California is a really diverse, you know, we've got lots of diversity in our ecosystems here, and where ranchers and farmers, you guys know this well, say, well, that can happen there, but it won't happen at my ranch because, you know, we're around the corner and it's different here. We're doing the same metrics in all those places. So it looks at the Sierras all the way here to here at the coast. And so there's also a technology called PastureMap, which is a phone web-based application for tracking cattle grazing that actually started here based on a Stanford Business School student who years ago came to us and said, what would help you guys do better with your cattle grazing? And so this is the kind of stuff that we're working on. Recently, we started.
I didn't know you started PastureMap started there, Wendy. We're going to be using that out here too.
Oh, you are? Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, Christine Sue started it, but we had a conversation over breakfast when she was a student, and that was, you know, the early days of getting that started. And we walked around the ranch and showed her how our grazing planning happened on a big sheet of white paper, and it sure would be nice to be able to do it out in the field. So she took it off from there, and we actually hosted their team of 10 people, a bunch of engineers and salespeople, a couple weeks ago. So anyway, but that, I'm glad you're trying that out, Jill, because I think it's the other tools we've looked at who are competitive with that space. FarmOS is an open source web-based application for tracking farm and ranch management. That's really good tool for some measurements. PastureMap's really good at some measurements. There's not one yet that we would say measures all the things we're doing, but we're a pretty unique place because we want it to be able to measure both our grazing and our experiments. And, you know, we decide to do a compost experiment or a bacterial fungal ratio experiment. Well, where do you put that in one of these tools? So.
That is very exciting stuff, because not only does it allow to overlay this data and metadata into smarter farming, but as we talked about with Left Coast Grass-Fed, boy, that information can be layers deep valuable to consumers who may care about the environmental impact of that primal cut of meat. Or they want to know how positive bovine can be actually on open range lands for sequestering carbon. Or they just want to know that animal was responsibly raised with proper use of medication or feed. And that's basically a void within our food systems. And it does create an opportunity for food animals to be a real the anchor industry to move that forward. So, and I was going to mention too that I was actually had it written down here that Tomcat is the venerable mixing bowl of technology. So there's a shout out to your husband Rob. I'll put a link to that on the write up here, so we make sure that he has reference to that too. Hey Jill, let's talk. I want to ask you a question about this too, because according to your bio at Stonebarns, you work to forge partnerships among farmers, engineers, policymakers, chefs, conservationists, educators, and others to help bring about a system of agriculture and way of eating that reflects the values of ecological health, strong communities, and the integrity of place, region and season. So those are ambitious goals, obviously, right? And that's a an approach of looking at really a perfect food system. But you guys have developed into this epicenter of a proving ground for future food systems and regenerative agricultural models. You've got an unbelievable staff of people that are really pushing the envelope there. So we talked about you've got 100 to 150,000 people coming to visit both your facility, your farm, and your and Blue Hill, the restaurant there. So how do you manage all of the moving parts of that physical location? And then how do you harmonize that across the long shadow that you cast in this broader food system reform, which Stone Barns is obviously taking a leadership stake in?
Yeah, the analog I like to use when people ask me about kind of the variety of activities that happen here is that we have a dream to become the Monterey Bay Aquarium of farming. And what I mean by that is, We want to be an inspirational place where you can visit and get lost kind of in aesthetic rapture or connection to nature and really be in an open frame of mind to learn and to think about food. So, you know, we want to have visitors here who come and have an experience that piques their interest in the food conversation. We aspire to be an organization that contributes to conversation and research that will encourage more regenerative agriculture across the country. So the kinds of things that Wendy was just talking about, you know, what technologies are most effective for farmers, what kinds of metrics or indicators should we look at to really test and prove regenerative agriculture. We recently did, in partnership with several other organizations, a grass-fed beef study that looked at the market in the United States. So we want to conduct projects and be parts of projects like that so that we have a serious research agenda. And then, you know, last but not least, we really want to use the voice and reach of Stone Barns to connect consumers to this work. So an example of that is a project we did over the past couple of years, which was putting together a book. Wendy actually was one of the contributors to the book. It's Letters to a Young Farmer. And the idea behind the book was that we would find 30 people who could contribute a letter or an essay that would provide wisdom, guidance, insight to future farmers. And it was a project that was really designed not only to speak to young farmers, but to speak to someone who might pick up the book because they read everything Barbara Kingsolver writes. So we had many of the usual suspects who would attract people who are farming or part of the food conversation, but we had some people who maybe you wouldn't expect to be in the book to try to attract the interest of others. So they would become part of this conversation to explore the challenges and opportunities for young people who want to grow our food. So we try, you know, we harmonize it by really trying to provide inroads for many different audiences who can help plan for the kind of food future that we want in this country.
And that book was fantastic, and that's exactly how I went through it. Oh, look at this. Look who wrote this article. I got to read it. It was just, you had an incredible collaboration amongst some of the true thought leaders in the space that have unique insight and seeing it. And what was great is they were short essays. You could tear through them as you went, as you wanted to. And the more you read, the more you wanted to read the rest of them. And, you know, speaking of that, Jennifer, if you both had a chance to see the Wendell Berry, the book, the Look and See, excuse me, from PBS, just put it out the other night. It was kind of a hour-long documentary, and it was interesting. You know, obviously Wendell Berry being really the modern-day Thoreau, our Southern Thoreau, talking about as many things that we're talking about, but in clean and concise ways, really just a wordsmith master at getting the points across. And what was interesting in that PBS special, I think it was Independent Lens, they talked about Earl Butz, which obviously was much of the impetus that we've seen in policy.
Get big or get out.
You got it. That's the impetus of since the 1970s. Get big or get out. And really the what led to the cheapening of food and the real mining of soils. It was much of his approach, and what we've seen across the board is these models are not benefiting short-term revenue, which are not benefiting the farmers nor the communities they serve. It's really been a huge effect on regional agricultural systems. So talk about a failed experiment with across the board. But I bring that up because the last question I want to ask you both, we'll start with you, Wendy, because your bosses, Kat Taylor and Tom Steyer, are very active in policy and have been very involved in dealing with environmental issues, especially out in California, in Keystone Pipeline. But I've really culminated around this idea of food agriculture, specifically regenerative agricultural models. So how important is national policy in bolstering this this alternative production? Can we be reliant on a grassroots movement, or will the grassroots movement eventually lead to transformative change within policymakers? So, Wendy, please, if you could start, and then Jill, jump in, and love to hear your thoughts on that, too.
Well, there are lots of market externalities in the current agriculture system that distort the market and make food, some kinds of food, very affordable and some kind of food not very affordable. So that is one area where I think policy could have a big impact. Farm Bill, for example, which does a lot of great things, but also incentivizes some practices that at this point are not it's not as progressive as we would want if we really want to build a regenerative agriculture system. California launched the Healthy Soils Initiative, and that's been an exciting program to see what other kinds of practices, regenerative practices, where landowners could be compensated for practices that are building healthy soil. On the grass-fed side, we've been watching the grass-fed. USDA is not strict about the grass-fed label. The country of origin label has also been pulled, so there's a lot of confusion for consumers about where beef comes from, what is a local, locally produced protein source, what does grass-fed actually mean? Is it actually really grass, or is it fed all kinds of stuff? So those are a few areas that seem like opportunities. Crop insurance is another opportunity. Crop insurance that would actually provide for regenerative practices would be an exciting offering in the marketplace. So Jill, I'm sure, has lots of ideas as well, but there's just a few.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that calorie dense foods are cheaper because farm policies subsidize some of the least healthy calories in the supermarket is a real problem, and I think that it's imperative that policies change so they're not exclusively supporting the majority of those subsidies aren't used to support corn and soy. I mean, corn's used to make things like green apple Jolly Rancher Pop-Tarts and chicken popper kebab Lunchables and cheese nips, and those foods, therefore, are very inexpensive and become a preferred choice if you're on a really tight budget. So I'd like to see changes in policies that make healthy foods more or equally affordable. So I guess stated more simply, our tax dollars subsidize the most unhealthy foods in the supermarket, and we don't do a lot to subsidize and support carrots and broccoli. And we don't do a lot to support agricultural research that advances regenerative practices or conservation. I think there are some really bright policy opportunities on the horizon to support young farmers. The National Young Farmers Coalition has been pushing for loan forgiveness, arguing that farming, feeding our country, is a public service. There are lots of really innovative things happening on the kind of land access front from a policy perspective, and states looking at freeing up state land to create more access for farming. So I think that all of those policy efforts will be essential to driving the kind of big change that Wendy and I are interested in. But there are many, many really good things happening at kind of a grassroots level or in the private sector, I think it's been interesting to watch companies like Campbell's and General Mills and Unilever and Danone really start to investigate sustainable agriculture and organic food companies. I get the sense that they are being driven by their consumers to think about how they'll make a shift. There are many interesting fast casual restaurants popping up all over the country, the Sweetgreens, the Diggins, the True Food Kitchens. And I think there are an enormous number of community-founded organizations that are thriving. So whether it's Wholesome Wave, working on SNAP programs that double your value if you're buying fruits and vegetables, or community organizations like the ones in Detroit that have led to the building of more than 1,000 urban gardens, or Karen Washington working on retirement planning for young farmers. So I feel very encouraged by those kind of grassroots and local and national efforts that are being driven by individual and creative individuals and creative communities. So I think it's going to be a marriage of both actions that come from the ground up and hopefully high-level policy change over time.
Hmm. Those were wonderful. My pen ran out of ink. I was taking so many notes of how all those great examples. So that was fantastic. And I will say, both for you, Wendy, and for Jill, the epicenters that you both have established, until we get to those policy changes, really are the ones that are leading force. So I can't thank you both enough for partaking and in Sourcing Matters and in our show today. Wendy, where can we learn more about Tomcat Ranch and Left Coast Grass Fed?
Thanks. Yeah, Tomcat Ranch has a website, Tomcat, cat with a K. And also we're pretty active on Facebook because there's a lot of interesting articles out there that we'd like to keep sharing with people every day.
And Jill, where can we learn more about what's going on at Stone Barns and read up on the Stone Barns Exchange Fellowship Program that just got released?
Yes, stonebarnscenter.org. The go-to resource.
The go-to resource. I like it. And both great mailing lists, too. I would encourage our listeners to get on both and social media. You guys are excellent. Both your teams are excellent on not only sharing information about what you're doing, but also facilitating and sharing valuable information about what's happening within the industry around food, ag, environment, and circular economy. So wonderful. Thanks. Thank you very much. And so as your host, your Sean Hannity for the good side, how's that? That would actually work for about 10% of what he works for. I'll do that. I'll take it on the chin and handle that. And maybe your voice that is soon to be heard. Jill, I'm going to adopt that. I like that. Thank you very much. I appreciate you both taking the time. It was a wonderful conversation, and I'll just say until next time.
Terrific. Thanks, Aaron. Jill, nice to be talking to you.
Thank you. Talk to you both soon.
Thank you very much.